Welcome to the 18th installment of Piper Sandler's 30-Minute Market Insight Series. The goal of this conference call series is to take a holistic approach to understanding the marketplace by featuring a different sector and subject matter experts to share timely insights that influence all industries. My name is Pierce Hammond, and I'm a senior research analyst with Simmons Energy, a division of Piper Sandler. I am joined today by Ian McPherson, senior research analyst covering oilfield service, and Mark Lear, senior research analyst covering exploration and production. Today, we will be discussing the key takeaways from the recent Simmons Energy Glen Eagles Goes virtual conference. The call is designed to be no longer than 30 minutes. If you have any questions following the call, please reach out to me or your Simmons Piper representative. And as a reminder, this call cannot be referenced in any articles, and this conversation should be considered off the record. Before I turn the call over to Ian to discuss OFS or oilfield services takeaways and then to Mark to discuss upstream takeaways, I want to share some high-level thoughts that we had as a research team on the energy sector following the conference, and I guess specifically what really struck us about energy and was reaffirmed at our conference. So I think the first point is that this is definitely a severely disrupted industry, even beyond the secular challenges of renewables and ESG, or environmental social governance, stigmatization. Yes, while a COVID-19 vaccine and increasingly cyclical normalization will likely unfold in 2021, the demand element of oil is unlikely to fully normalize until 2023 or 2024, and not just due to COVID, but also due to the fact that this pandemic has pulled forward the future. And we are now far more comfortable living in a Zoom world, and this impacts commuting and air travel. And the second point is that the global energy business, and especially the lower 48, is structurally overcapitalized, and the industry needs to shrink in order to grow. Majors are frantically trying to sell refineries, and the lower 48 energy value chain is in the process of responding to a meaningfully redefined market opportunity requiring a multi-year rationalization and consolidation wave. The third point is that austerity is definitely the dominant theme of the industry, requiring a radical shrinking of reinvestment, our Darwinian right-sizing, and an acute focus on balance sheet management. And the fourth point is it is clear why energy is now the smallest sector in the S&P 500. For many investors, energy is in the too hard pile. In addition, other cyclical sectors have cleaner and more compelling stories, and as the economy recovers, those sectors will likely be off to the races long before energy. It was noteworthy that at our conference that a best-in-class energy private equity leader stated that he would not be overweight energy as an asset class right now. He did state that the bright spot on the horizon is where the upstream businesses are restructured to only have to invest 60 to 70% of their cash flow to maintain the business, which should result in blossoming and more durable free cash flow. Now, at some point, a cyclical opportunity and lower 48 reinvestment cycle should occur, but it is not on the immediate horizon. In addition, as lower 48 wanes, the world will be increasingly relying on insecure sources of supply, read OPEC, which at some point could drive energy security to the front burner. Overall, the message from the conference was not hopeless despair, but rather that this is going to be a long haul on fixing the industry. For equity investors, they should continue to focus their attention on best-of-breed companies with solid balance sheets, free cash flow potential, and the ability to merge a winner when the cycle eventually turns. Now let me turn the call over to Ian McPherson to share his key takeaways for the oilfield services sector following the conference. Ian?
Thanks, Pierce. Yeah, we did get a fairly comprehensive update of the conference on the services side from a number of larger and smaller players, both within oil service and equipment, as well as E&P. And these basically all tracked squarely in line with the austerity narrative that we've been hearing about all year. It is still very much a right-sizing consolidation and rationalization story here that's going to take some time to play out. Mid-cycle is definitely the buzzword that's trending prevalently these days, since current activity levels are generally regarded as unsustainably depressed. So we've spoken a lot with companies in terms of their 2 to 3 year view on activity levels that might ultimately be required to stabilize U.S. production at or near present levels, absent a call on any resumed modest growth. So from a rig count perspective, we saw a 2014 peak of about 2,000 U.S. land rigs compressed to a 2018 peak of 1,000. And while we've been bouncing around this present trough level of around 240 rigs for most of this summer, our working assumption has been for a recovery back towards 500 to 600 rigs by 2022. And then similarly, in terms of U.S. completion crews relative to a 2018 peak of 450 plus, and a recent pre-COVID cadence of around 300 crews in the first quarter of this year, we've seen an initial bounce from the Q2 trough that was as low as around 50 frac spreads to around 100 presently. This view meshes pretty well with the updated Q3 outlook that we got from Solaris yesterday evening that estimated Q3 activity recovering by about 60 to 70% sequentially. That more or less connects the dots from around 300 crews in the first quarter back to around 100 in the third quarter. Although Solaris did also express a little bit of caution with regard to Q4 visibility as well. Most of the leading protagonists in the completions value chain subscribed to a mid-cycle call on 200 to 250 working frac fleets in order to stabilize domestic production. That has certainly been espoused and reiterated by Liberty, for example, with their recently announced consolidation of one stem from Schlumberger. And Halliburton also corroborated that view generally in their fireside chat with Bill Herbert. But in a world where we really find ourselves grasping for silver linings, where there's just not a lot to get excited about near term for oil service, there were a few. First, we are seeing pretty significant movement on the consolidation and rationalization front already. For example, following the Keene-CJ merger last year that produced next year, we now have Liberty acquiring one stem. We have the Wilkes brothers making a run at Calfrac, and several others, including BJ, have recently entered Chapter 11 and or effectively folded camp on smaller pressure pumping operations that are proven underscaled and unprofitable. So consequently, while the total supply of horsepower in the U.S. appeared to have already corrected from around 25 million last year by our estimates to closer to 20 million at the beginning of this year, this looks like it's still a moving target, moving lower, and also consolidating into fewer, stronger hands. Another silver lining that seemed to be reaffirmed by large cap service is the collective wherewithal to shore up their margins at a much more benign threshold than most of us with earnings models had estimated coming into this downturn. The combination of truly massive cost structure reforms, ongoing digitalization, remote ops and other technology deployment, and by the company's own accounts, relatively little room to give on the pricing front, the outlook on margin stabilization and recovery, at least for the strongest and the fittest, is pretty decent for now, and it should allow for healthy incrementals when activity does eventually begin to inflect. So those were some of the key takeaways from the service discussions. Now, when you overlay some of these assumptions for a mid-cycle recovery scenario, however, with what the E&Ps are saying with regard to their capital plans, it does still seem like there's a chasm there to be bridged. And I mean, correct me, Mark, where you might disagree, but coming out of the Q2 calls, it struck me that the prevailing message for most of those companies was that their run rate activity levels into next year at the then current strip, which was a little better than the strip today, was more consistent with what they're running presently in the second half of this year, as opposed to closer to where they were in the first quarter. There were a few noted exceptions in the form of Pioneer and EOG that specified a need to ramp back up towards more sustainable maintenance levels. But at least with your presenting companies at our conference, I didn't necessarily hear many or any of them discussing meaningful upside to their present activity levels. Is that a fair inference?
Yeah, I'd say that with the, you know, you call out the two exceptions there. You know, certainly EOG has been pretty upfront about needing to ramp up activity to get back to a maintenance level of activity. And then with Pioneer's plan to, you know, get back on the growth path in 2021, that, you know, they'd also be increasing rig count, pretty materially, roughly 2x the current level of activity. So, but other than those two, that sounds about right.
Yeah, thanks. And then another takeaway from your panels that struck me as interesting was Concho's discussion of how they're modifying their lift program and certainly beginning to favor more application of gas lift over ESPs, just given the, less of a call on immediate growth and maybe a desire for a flatter, shallower profile on the wells. That's something you and Hanwen have written about recently with your Midland Basin update as well. So I think for those who are watching developments within artificial lift, that was noteworthy to me. And then last one, Pierce, for me, just on the international outlook, the large cap service companies seem to be more or less on the same page with their respective outlooks that essentially frame the expectation for next year for international as a mirror image of this year. So in other words, a slightly later trough in activity in spending that would occur late this year or early next year, followed by a steady recovery from there, therefore resulting in flat or maybe flat to up year-on-year full-year comps for 21 over 20 for international spending, again, with some optimism for improved incremental margins relative to their recent experience and results. So those are my key takeaways, really, on the service side, and I'd be happy now to pass it over to Mark to go on to the E&P side.
Yeah, thanks, Ian. Good afternoon, everyone, and thanks for joining us. We did have the pleasure of catching up with senior management at EOG and Concho at our conference and touched on several key themes for the upstream group, including U.S. onshore growth and reinvestment, the improving cost structure of the business and the impact on free cash flow, federal leasehold risk exposure, and then finally, the impact that the current price environment's having on operations and asset productivity. For EOG, while the message out of 2Q earnings felt like a company that was gearing up for growth in 2021, given the robust free cash flow outlook at the strip, but the message stress, really has changed. It's stressing more budgeting based on a conservative price deck and getting back to a maintenance level of activity by late 2020. Company remains very comfortable with the sustainability of the dividend, but did not indicate an increase was in the cards in the near term. Federal leasehold exposure, has been a big drag on the stock as well as a few others in our coverage group. And the company discussed confidence in executing in the Delaware for 8 years. They had previously discussed that, being kind of a four-year runway with 2Q results. And then, while the Eagle Ford well performance has continued a multi-year trend of degradation, EOG continues to deliver strong returns in the play and has not altered interlateral spacing to increase the inventory runway. With recent gas exploration success in Trinidad, the company remains focused on oil and combo opportunities in its domestic exploration efforts. And therefore, it's not indicative of a strategy shift as it pertains to gas opportunities relative to oil. And then while the company has discussed a greater focus on greenfield exploration, it does remain focused on resource expansion opportunities in its legacy operating areas, discussing the recent success it's had in the Wolfcamp M in the Delaware. Turning to Concho. The company continues to message that 2021 is likely to encompass a maintenance program as it awaits a stronger signal from the market to return to growth and focuses on free cash flow generation and debt reduction. The company's debt reduction goals are not mutually exclusive from increasing shareholder return, including base and variable dividend. The company also discussed the potential of stock repurchases as it's keenly focused on the relative underperformance of the stock and the oil rebound and the relative multiple discount that it currently sports. While the federal leasehold exposure has weighed on the stock, the company does not think any changes in federal permitting will have a material impact on capital efficiency, assuming no federal activity starting in 2021, and does not plan to alter allocation ahead of any administration change. While the company has historically been an active consolidator in the Permian and sees the need for further consolidation, Concho itself does not see itself being a buyer in the current environment. On the operational front, Concho is returning to 2018 form with strong results in the Delaware program in the first half of 20. And, you know, while changes in artificial lift application in the Midland, you know, ultimately will result in lower peak rates but flatter declines, we are starting to see some strong improvement in Midland performance relative to 2019 as well. So that wraps up my comments on the upstream, and with that, I can turn it back to Pierce.
Yeah, well, thank you, Mark, and thank you, Ian, for the helpful color on both the upstream and the oilfield services sector. And I would like to touch on a few more takeaways from the conference. And both Ian and Mark talked about consolidation, but I think as we talked to everyone at the conference, and what became apparent to us is we do think it's going to be kind of a slow to start an overdue consolidation wave. I mean, energy companies understand the necessity of consolidation, and we think that's something that will become even more apparent as the energy transition unfolds in the years ahead. But there is a lack of willpower to jumpstart the process, either as a buyer, because buyers are worried that they're going to kind of get punched in the face by the equity market if they make an acquisition, or as a seller. There's some reluctance to sell at these levels, as well as cultural and management incentive issues. And while investors hope a consolidation wave is ahead, commentary from our conference was definitely a little more subdued on this front. Bottom line, a long overdue comprehensive industry consolidation remains more aspirational than reality. One private equity panelist at the conference stated that activism is more likely in the equity market and is more likely than not in the upstream sector due to the need for consolidation. But activism would be driven by the reluctance of some upstream management teams to give up the C-suite. Another thing that we've, you know, a theme that a lot of people talk about these days and was very apparent coming out of the conference was the higher cost of capital. Specifically, the capital availability for the oil and gas sector continues to be limited. The resulting higher cost of capital will have positive ramifications for production discipline, leading eventually to tightening supply-demand imbalances. Energy lenders and private equity participants at the conference highlighted the difficulty Lower 48 upstream has in securing funding. We had some bank lenders at the conference, and they stated that fall bank redeterminations would likely be flat to lower due to hedges rolling off despite better strip prices. In fact, both of the banks that were there were being conservative as it related to new energy loans, and that they were able to get better covenants and loan pricing in most instances. Overall, these banks that were present at our conference thought the current down cycle is worse than the previous down cycle in 15-16, but that the banks were well positioned to deal with the losses. Private equity funds and capital markets, though, were not willing to step up to support struggling companies, which is different than the prior downturn in 15-16. In fact, one of the banks said that they felt like private equity sponsors were not taking as longer term a view as the bankers would have thought. Of note, one of the banks stated that there were several PE funds that they would not do business with in the future. Oil field services continues to be the most challenged subsector within energy as far as the banks are concerned, but the good news is that the banks have substantially reduced their exposure to the oil field services sector since the 2014-2016 downturn. And then what about bankruptcy restructuring? We were really pleased to have an attorney from Haynes Boone at the conference. And Haynes Boone has the largest number of bankruptcy lawyers in Texas. And he believes that the current downturn for Lower 48 is worse than the one in the 1980s. Of note, in the 1980s, energy companies did not have the complicated debt structures that they do now. But one important distinction he made is his assertion that the downturn could be worse in the 1980s pertained just to the energy sector and not necessarily to the state of Texas. Those that have the memory remember back the 80s was a bad time for the state of Texas, but that's because of a real estate collapse, banking, savings and loan collapse. That's not occurring now. He believes, the attorney from Haynes Boone believes, 300 producers could file for bankruptcy this year. 240 had filed through August. On the oil field services side, 221 companies had filed through last month. Keep in mind that these stats do not fully capture the state of despair in the oil field services sector, given that many smaller mom-and-pop oil field services companies choose to just shut down rather than file bankruptcy. And lastly, it seems PE, or private equity, is likely to invest in some bankrupt companies and assets. The other thing at the conference is that it definitely seemed like the energy transition story and renewables and the movement away from fossil fuels was the 800-pound gorilla in the room, as it is at all energy conferences these days. And for those interested in learning more about the energy transition and renewable energy, I would encourage you to check out our latest report, Exploring Renewable Energy and the Unfolding Energy Transition, which was published earlier this week. Please see your Simmons Energy or Piper Sandler representative to receive a copy of this detailed report. Now, we've been pleased. We've gotten some emails in here and some questions from some of the attendees, so we appreciate that. And so let's address three of these questions. The first question that came in is, when will investors return to equity and debt markets, and what will catalyze the return? Mark, do you have any thoughts on that?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I think that's a debated topic and one that we could probably take up the whole 30-minute time slot on. But, you know, I do think, you know, that's been a big debate for the last 3-4 years in the space. And I think with the recent trend and conversation coming out of 2Q focused on the E&P frameworks and reinvestment rates, you know, are a really good start. The shift to cash flow versus growth and you know, putting capital back in the ground is certainly being positively received. I think it certainly improves the line of sight on improving you know, free cash flow and capital return. And then, you know, as you had said in your earlier remarks, Pierce, I think ultimately will be a big tailwind for the macro as U.S. shale growth is a thing of the past. But, you know, again, these frameworks, I think, you know, kind of set a yardstick for upstream, something that these companies will be measured on and be, you know, held to their word to own up to, right? So I do think this is a very, you know, positive step in the right direction. And I think, you know, as we see it show up in ultimately, you know, stronger, higher EV to free cash flow yields, I think the value proposition in upstream is going to be, you know, hard to pass up. It's just, I think, going to, you know, take some time to unveil itself. But I think we're certainly heading in the right direction.
Excellent. Thank you. The second question that came in is what are some high-level views of impacts from the upcoming presidential election? And I would just say that, number one, this is definitely going to be a very consequential election for not just the presidential election, but also the Senate, as far as energy policy is concerned. So if President Trump is able to win another term, certainly the impetus for renewables won't be as strong as it will be under a Biden administration. But as we outlined in our renewables report that I referenced a few minutes ago, the drivers of renewables are, number one, lower cost, and those costs have come down quite a bit and will continue to fall, and then policy support, which is still very, very strong. So even if President Trump has another 4 years, we still think the energy transition is going to continue to unfold, and there certainly could be the rate of growth may not be as much as it would be in a Biden administration, but it's going to continue to unfold. But if you switch gears to a Biden administration, he's talked about putting together a $2 trillion plan to tackle renewables and climate change. And I think overall, the big takeaway is he's likely to put in a lot of policies that would incentivize the use of renewable energy and disincentivize traditional, fossil fuels. And so, again, the energy transition would likely move at a more turbocharged pace under a Biden administration. Some of the things he's talked about is by 2035 having zero carbon within the power generation stack in the U.S., as well as wanting to get to a net carbon zero, which would mean zero carbon emissions by 2050. Now, we can debate the efficacy of that, whether it's really going to happen, but either way, that's the direction things want to go in. Plus, there'll probably be more stringent requirements on the industry as it relates to methane capture, et cetera. We don't think that a Biden administration would result in the banning of fracking or anything like that. But those are our high-level views, and so to close, it is a very consequential election. And the last question is regarding consolidation. How do you see this playing out? As this individual who sent the question said, they were surprised that large and mega cap companies haven't been more aggressive on takeouts. Ian or Mark, do you all have any thoughts on that?
Yeah, sure. I can kick it off and then hand it to Ian. But yeah, I mean, it hasn't surprised us yet that we haven't seen a big swath of deals. I mean, I think, Noble, certainly came as a bit of a surprise. And I think it was really just, regarding the timing, in our, experience in covering the upstream space over the past 15 years or so, it's just low price environments are typically not the time you see, deals occur. I think particularly now with a group that, for the most part in the public space, balance sheets are in decent shape. There's not a lot of stress. I think these management teams would rather hold out for a higher price environment to, capture more value for the shareholder. So, hasn't really been a surprise yet on that case. Certainly, has been a lot of clamoring over the past several years about, all equity, no premium type deals. I guess the Noble deal is probably as close as we've come to something like that. But, and you had brought it up previously, I think, typically management teams are pretty, entrenched and I think, ultimately, are looking for opportunities to maximize, value, And I just think a low price environment, is certainly not one where we'd expect to see, a big uptick in M&A. That's probably my higher level view there.
Thanks, Mark. Ian, anything you want to add?
Yeah, I mean, I think obviously service is in a position of having to consolidate as an imperative, and there are a lot of hurdles that you need to be able to cover in terms of, meeting on valuation, meeting on social, C-suite leadership resolutions, and, finding sensible marriages of like-for-like cap structures. But you also have to have the will to be a protagonist, and so many times you're not rewarded as a consolidation leader in this industry. I think the favorable re-rate that Liberty has received on the back of their OneStim acquisition, of course, with a lot of accretion that comes with that. That's good for the industry. I think, more well-received deals should create a virtuous cycle with regard to industry sentiment and willingness to push forward with more consolidation.
Well, thank you, Ian, and thank you, Mark, as well. And with that, we will wrap up today's discussion. And we want to thank the attendees for being on today's call. And if you do have any questions, feel free to reach out to any Ian, Mark, or myself, or any of your representatives from Simmons and Piper Sandler. A replay of this presentation will be made available, and please join us next time on October 1st at 12 noon Central, as we will be hearing from Michael Lavery, Senior Research Analyst covering packaged food and tobacco. And with that, you may now disconnect. Thank you.